On this episode of Basecamp Live, it's time to check in again with Brooke Hempel, Senior Vice President at the Barna Group. As a research firm, they are tracking the latest trends and changes going on across our culture, of which there are many happening very fast these days. Their latest project reexamines Gen Z. That's the name for those between 6 to 22 years old, basically any K-12 or college-age person. And while in some ways the world is getting smaller and people of various ages do share a lot of the same mindsets because of universal media and technology, generational differences are real, and we need to pay attention to them. Because the questions that all people have had to wrestle with throughout all time, issues around identity and belonging and purpose, which we know are ultimately answered in Christ, we still have to engage and guide and teach people where they are on their journey. So how do we as parents, educators, and influencers best support, guide, and encourage this generation? Well, stay tuned to this episode of Basecamp Live.
Mountains, we all face them as we seek to influence the next generation. Get equipped to conquer the challenges, summit the peak, and shape exceptionally thoughtful, compassionate, and flourishing human beings. We call it Ancient Future Education for Raising the Next Generation. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Now your host, Davies Owens.
Well, Brooke Hempel, welcome back to Basecamp Live. This is the fifth time you've been on, so welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be with you again.
Yeah, it's so good to have you. I think the last time you were on was actually November of 19, which seems like, 300 years ago in the scheme of right. Our culture and COVID and life. And if folks didn't hear you before, you need to know about Brooke and the great work she's doing there at Barna. She's the Senior Vice President of Research and conducts and analyzes research to understand what's going on in our culture related to value and beliefs, attitudes, behaviors. Barna's been around, since early 80s doing research?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you guys team up with all kinds of wonderful ministries and organizations just to kind of take a look at what's happening in the lives of our culture. And we're going to talk about the newest volume 2, looking at Gen Zers. So let's jump right into this, Brooke. So first of all, people are, two obvious questions are like, who's Gen Z? Let's make sure we've got that down. And then maybe the second question is just, why do we need to care so much about generational differences? Is that really a big deal? So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a great example of it right now. Which is generational science really a thing? And I even just made it a thing by calling it a science, but I think it's a science. So what we're actually doing is we're studying culture and we're saying there are these broader cultural and geopolitical events that shape an entire group of people in an age group. And so usually that means that something has happened during their childhood or early adulthood years that have truly shaped their worldview and what's important to them. And in this case of Gen Z, we're seeing it right now. Like COVID is actually shaping a generation and the way that they think about relationships and the way that they interact with technology and the way that they think about education and so many different factors of their life that it's shaping. So that's the concept behind why we discern different generations, because they have these experiences at these critical moments in time that really do shape who they are as a cohort.
And I think obviously there's a lot of generational overlap, especially as our world seems to be getting smaller with technology. I mean, it used to be, pockets of culture in the U.S. were incredibly different from each other, but it seems like everybody's sort of drinking from the same fountain. So on the one hand, it seems like we're all kind of being shaped in the same way. On the other hand, you're right, generations are so different from each other. I on Tuesday nights, I'm involved in an organization called Rebuilding Generations, which actually uses automobile restoration to minister with kids. So we have about 8 to 10 high schoolers in my shop every Tuesday night. That's a whole long story. But last night we were working together in the shop and I'm listening to these high schoolers talk and I'm like, I am so old. Like, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know what the pop culture references, the movies. Right. And I'm thinking I'm on top of this, but I am so disconnected from so much of what is shaping them. So it is very generationally specific. So,
yeah. And it is pop culture, but it also can be things like, wars are the most common things.
Yeah.
Conflict of various sorts. It can be legislation. So for this generation, legislation on particular topics have actually shaped how they think about things. So there's all sorts of, when I say geopolitical, I'm talking everything in addition to pop culture that kind of frames their world.
Yeah.
Technology is a huge part of it as well. So yeah, you can definitely discern the difference. And you're right in that it's very fluid across different places. So I have a young millennial African-American pastor that I do a lot of work with. And he says, he teaches a congregation that's all five generations that are currently alive. And he says, I got to be honest, I will meet someone online who is from Japan and have more in common with them as a millennial than I do with some of the elders in my own church.
Wow.
Because of the shared experience we have through technology and media.
Yeah, it's
really wild.
Well, and again, we could talk about the kind of the sociology of it, because it is, it's, that's a very fascinating statement. It used to be more sort of, you know, boundaries and countries and so on, but you're right, just the bridging that's happening. But so again, with Gen Z, we're talking about, so these are what, 6 to 22 year olds? Is that sort of the current age?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know exactly where that lowest line is, but somewhere thereabouts. Yes. Yeah, so the high end right now is about 22. So they're basically your college students and below, and we'll draw the line somewhere in elementary school.
So for Basecamp, I mean, really, if you have a child in your classroom or a child at home or a student in the classroom, this is who we're talking about. I mean, this is pretty much kindergarten through college. If you're born 99 to 2015, that's who we're talking about. So, and obviously if you're born in 98, it doesn't mean you don't have any of these tendencies, but, let's jump in. Okay. Help us understand both kind of what did you find, especially in this second round, and maybe back us up kind of what happened volume one. And then again, a lot of culture and life transpired, and then you went back and researched again. What did you find?
Yeah. So actually that's good to talk about history. We did the first study when Gen Z turned 18. The oldest Gen Zer was 18. And we said, okay, they're now like adulting. Let's see what this is like. Who are they? And now that they are beginning to have impact on their world. And so we did that study about 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. And it was huge. I mean, our team was prepared to talk about technology, but we really hadn't comprehended what that meant in terms of shaping them. We discovered a lot of these what I would call mental health concerns with the generation, not just that they existed, but that they existed even younger than we thought. We discovered that their worldview around religion and spirituality was very different, that they were, if they were of some faith, they were very comfortable being that faith. They were kind of committed to that, even though they didn't talk about it as much. And if they were not of a faith, and increasingly they were not of a faith, that was just assumed to be the norm. And they had very often no foundation of knowledge of, in this case, Christianity, as we were asking questions about, you know, perceptions of scripture and Jesus and who is he and what do you think about God? And they really just did not have a lot of foundational knowledge at all. So those were some ahas that we realized. The trend lines that we've been watching over time just sped up with this generation. And so we were looking at a group of kids who were more shaped by the world than we had realized. And also were being shaped by forces that we as parents truly didn't understand when it came to technology. We didn't understand the way that it was actually rewiring their brain. And that sounds dramatic, but it is actually true. Chemically, things happen when they use technology at a young age. And so we began to see what that was doing to the way that these kids processed, the way that they experienced emotions, relationships, the way they thought about their future. So all that kind of came to light. And then that was, you know, 3.5, 4 years ago. And we said, all right, so that was the beginning of them entering college or entering adulthood. You know, now what's it like where they've kind of been on their own for a bit. We started preparing to do this second kind of update before COVID. And so, of course, when COVID hit, we're like, well, now we really want to know. This has been such a disrupted experience for them. What is this like? How are they handling this? And then all the different events, you know, that happened over the past year and a half.
Which
came
is,
into play, and we said it's a good time.
Yeah, like you said, I think things used to be, I remember hearing as a sociology major, I actually occasionally get to use this, it used to be that every 10 years or every decade was a sort of generational shift. What's mm-hmm. the frequency right now? I mean, it sounds like every 18 months. I mean, again, you've got Gen Z as a giant swath of people, but just that cultural shift and change seems like it's super fast. So
yeah, I mean, I would say we have really dramatic shifts about every 3 years right now. And if we were to look at a trend line, you would see this gentle slope of things on whatever issue. We actually look at a number of trends this way. We just randomly put different trends. We overlay the lines just to see what's going on. And we see these slopes that were just kind of gradual. It's normally what you see in data, you know, maybe like a 15 degree line, right? And then all of a sudden it's like, it's a 45 degree line. What just happened here?
Right.
And so the pace of change is much more rapid. So yeah, it's more in the 3 to 5 year range.
Which is again, shocking, because as we'll talk kind of after the break, get into kind of the nuts and bolts of, well, how do we engage effectively these students, especially as those parents and educators in classical Christian schools? Because I think we pride ourselves in kind of being a part of a methodology of teaching that stood the test of time, that spans the centuries. So there's a sense in which we are anchored deep and we're not going to change. At the same time, we're serving a student population that is extremely fast moving. And our assumptions of how we even taught or how we engaged our firstborn versus our last, or maybe our 12th grade class 4 years ago versus this year. I mean, there's a lot that we have to continually retool a bit. And that's scary, especially when we're, to my point earlier, talking to high schoolers. I'm like, I'm increasingly out of this loop. And then my second quick thought tied to this is just the challenge of, we talk a lot on Basecamp about what I call the 301 problem, which is we can control kind of 7:30 to 3 o'clock in our classical Christian schools. But boy, when that afternoon bell rings and Cyclops, the one-eyed technology monster, comes out, we're now on the, you know, we're no longer the dominant voice in the formation, even though we think we have invested, and we have, and we're doing all that we can. So it is concerning. I mean, how many other external voices are shaping and forcing a worldview and an understanding of who they are?
Well, and not to jump too far ahead, but I mean, that's why it's really important that education is a partnership with a family, with parents, because you can't have that sort of disconnect where we're doing one thing from 7:30 to 3, and then we're doing a completely other thing from 3 to 8 p.m. And so it really needs to have that sort of, even if not, you know, exact approach, like the messaging around it of like, how are we acting as a family, and how have we been intentional in this educational choice? And why are the things that you are learning and the ways that you're learning special and important to us as a family? And we want to continue those things at home. So yeah, otherwise you do get a really, really disjointed world, and kids just compartmentalize, and then they don't know how to actually live in the world.
And that's really, I think, in terms of kind of, we focus on some of the things we can talk about. You know, we look at identity and belonging and purpose, and how is that formed? I mean, throughout all of human history, the basic questions, who am I? What, you know, where am I going? What's my purpose? And obviously where the gospel fits in it. That's the core of everything. And you're right, if the answers to that are highly split and competing, it's not always an easy decision for young people to make. And I should have mentioned at the beginning, again, fifth time on, so I'm assuming a lot of people have heard you before, but you're not only in your role at Barna, but you are actually a parent at Heritage Prep in Atlanta, classical Christian school. So you're looking at this as a educational decision and how this plays out in that context, which we'll talk more about. But just, go ahead. For you.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I'm actually at a wonderful place right now, being able to see how that is developing. Our daughter's just entered the first high school class. And I'm seeing, okay, we're having to shift the way that we are educating to not only fit the third leg of the trivium, but also just to fit who these kids are as they develop. And so one of the small implications, just a quick example, was they switched the way that they were going to teach theology. They were going to teach, here's what the Bible teaches. And then you end with apologetics toward the latter end of high school. And they said, well, hold on. Like, if we don't start with, here's why the Bible is real, and here's why we defend it, then they're not going to believe. They're going to compartmentalize everything else that they learn. So we have to start with that, because we have to counteract the cultural narrative that this is just a little cutesy book. Like, this isn't just a cute book. This is a book that's grounded in truth, and we have to start there. So that's interesting, because that was, you know, for their age and for their kind of cultural experience, a way that they had to shift to adapt and help them to make sense of the world.
That is a fantastic example. And I'm sure that, again, we're going to come back to more of these, because that's exactly what we're talking about is, well, you've always taught theology in your classical Christian school the same way, or the way you parented 10 years ago or whatever. This is an active, dynamic moment we're in, and how do we pivot around? And I think people could say, well, you guys are just chasing the culture. You're trying to be relevant.
I mean, that's not what we're talking about. We're just literally,
right.
It's really sort of a missional mindset. It's always been odd to me, and it's just our American attitude. Like when we go overseas to do mission work, most of the time we're very open to kind of reading and understanding the culture and being respectful of the culture. But when we're home, we think one size fits all, and it's really not true. I mean, this is a mission field with totally different population than we're used to.
Yes.
Right. Yes. In front of us.
So, that's right.
Yeah. Well, take maybe a couple more discoveries of distinctives of Gen Z, and then we'll kind of, again, take a break and come back to some solutions for what do we do to engage them.
Yeah. So we spent a lot of time in this particular version doubling down on emotional and mental health, because we know that's been a continued area of concern, both for educators and for physicians, as well as parents. And also that it's something that was being shaped during COVID. So we wanted to see kind of what sort of sense of security, emotional security, did students have, or Gen Z have, or were they reporting? And then what was their sense of outlook on the world? And part of it was looking to see, like, are they being shaken? We know that there's high levels of anxiety and pressure in the generation. And we kind of confirmed that, although I will say, you know, it's like a quarter to a third, depending on how you're defining it. It's not 100%, right? Who are experiencing high levels of anxiety? There's still a lot of kids. But we were asking things like, you know, what sort of emotions do you regularly feel? And the good news is there are a lot of good, strong feelings that they're experiencing. And when I say feelings, because we're not just concerned about, oh, how are you doing? It's like, this is how they feel a sense of grounding, right? So there is kind of their emotional health. So they reported widely that they often felt loved and safe and happy with who they were and accepted, satisfied with their relationships, satisfied with my life and confident. That was so exciting that, you know, we were actually seeing that the nurturing that's happening for this generation is resulting in basically emotional stability. And that's really what we want. We want them to feel like they have a firm foundation so that they can grow on that.
You know, I'm just curious, because I know we, in a recent podcast with Keith McCurdy, who's often in Basecamp, who's a Christian family counselor and meets with, you know, hundreds of students and young people kind of late. And again, I know this study you guys have done, it's kind of been more, it was before COVID and then wrapping in the kind of the COVID influence. But his observation in COVID was that, most contrary to kind of popular opinion, is that because a lot of young people, students, Gen Zers were actually home and they weren't, you know, on four travel leagues and doing endless things, they actually were restored. And a lot of it is, it's a kind of a lot of the anxiety has more to do with parents who are overstressing and then passing that stress back down to their students, who are actually doing okay, comparatively speaking. Again, there are many who are not, but I guess, what's your take of that? Do you see some of that in the?
I think you hit on the head. I mean, for the most part, students actually fared better. The reality is it split the generation in a huge way, so that those who were struggling are struggling more. Those who maybe were, you know, on the margin are like being at home, having a stable schedule, having things calm down a little bit, maybe not being in as many social situations could have been very positive for them. So reminded them of safety and security. It reminded them of good relationships. So that is a positive. But I would say that anyone who is previously vulnerable has often experienced more vulnerability, more anxiety about income, if they had parents who were at risk of losing job or actually did, or maybe their education was harder to keep up with, you know, due to certain barriers that they faced. And so there is a portion that experienced more anxiety and more stress on their life. But I would say as a whole, there were a lot of really good changes that happened by students just taking a breather and being focused on the things that were most important, right? First things first.
So is that stress, anxiety? I mean, we think about the idea of identity and belonging and purpose. So specifically, what chips away at those three things from what you're seeing? Where is that detractor coming from?
So it's easy to blame technology, but when we say technology, it actually has a lot to do with what they're connecting with through the technology, right? So a couple of things that they're connecting with peers in ways that are sometimes not healthy. So we may have experiences of social media interactions that cause them to feel inept or, you know, not as good, or, you know, they're comparing in some way or another. There's very high comparison And it's not different than what you would have seen on a school playground decades prior. It just gets amplified. It goes a lot faster and it reaches a lot further because of the reach of social media, right? So those sorts of things are happening. And then the other is just the physical reality of, like, you have access to the whole world, and that's kind of overwhelming. It can be empowering because you're like, hey, whatever I'm interested in learning about, I can go find it. But it also can be overwhelming when you think of the volume of what you have to navigate through. And it can cause students to shut down when they realize, like, I'll take a few steps and go, oh my gosh, this is too much. And then they back up and shut down.
That makes sense. And so, you know, I wonder, let me ask this and then I want to go to a break, but, you know, start thinking about the antidotes to all of that. And obviously, again, when you're comparing yourself to the world, that's overwhelming to anybody. So we live in community. And again, I think the advantage of intact families and classical Christian schools is you have a community that has sort of got defined rules of engagement, and you can sort of find your place inside of these prescribed walls. Is that part of where, I mean, is that part of the answer? Is it just sort of free falling through the world and through life and social media? You really don't have anything to anchor to, and as opposed to somebody that's in a more established environment. So is that?
Yeah. I mean, I think the framing of this world, it is bigger than me, but I don't have to control it, is really helpful. And we can communicate that just through scripture and understanding who God is and what creation, you know, how it came to be. We can communicate that through our communities, our family. There's a lot of ways that you can communicate that, yes, this is a big world, but you're not alone in it, and you aren't responsible for navigating your way through it. So I do think that's really helpful. And then also helping them to realize that you don't have to make who you are, that God has already made you who you are, and he's made you perfect for how he wants you to be. And that's a ongoing work to be done. Yeah. Helping students see that.
it seems like increasingly, and I'm trying to, in my head, weaving various podcasts and conversations I've had, but it seems like kind of an overarching theme right now, in terms of what's the antidote to the culture, is we've got to move from kind of we taught that to you, you should know about it, to more of an immersive, you've really got to catch this through the culture of our school, through the way that we, to your reference earlier, for just how is the Bible taught? And I think, you know, a lot of classical Christians goes, well, we go to churches and we read the Bible at home, therefore we kind of check that box. It's like, no, I don't think that's happening. So let's adjust to correct for the fact that that's not actually happening without intentionality.
When we come back from our break, let's talk about head, heart, hands, because I think there's a lot there that we need to think about differently as educators.
Perfect. Let's take that break. We'll come right back with Brooke Hempel.
He's worked with families for more than 30 years as a licensed professional counselor and marriage family therapist. It's time for a quick encouragement on the best practices of raising the next generation. We call it a McCurdy moment.
So Keith, when you compare a classical Christian school pretty much to most other schools out there in the world today, it's a lot of work. And now compared to probably what students did even 50 or 100 years ago, it pales in comparison. Kids are capable of so much more than we often think they are. But the reality is that it is a lot of work. And I think there are times where we probably ask ourselves as parents, maybe as educators, is all this hard work really going to pay off in the end? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I get that question all the time from parents when they're evaluating, you know, gosh, you know, we're either looking at a Christian classical school, or we're there, and it does require more. It really does. It requires more effort. It requires more time. And something in them is telling them, wait a minute, is this really the best path, or should my child just be having more fun, having more leisure, you know? And what I tell parents is this. I said, there are absolutely times when a school, there's a small percentage of schools that I would believe sometimes are a little too heavy. No question about that. And there's a constant effort on the school's end to try to balance that. You know, what's the appropriate amount of work that's required? But in most of these situations, I push back on parents and say, you know, really think about, what do you want? Do you want momentary fun, or do you want long-term freedom? And what I mean by that is something I've seen in the lives of my own children, and something I've seen with hundreds of other graduates of Christian classical schools. And I'll tell a very quick story about my daughter. My daughter's a very strong-willed young lady. She is the type that when she graduates, she burns all the uniform and gets rid of all the bumper stickers, and, you know, she's on to the next thing. And when she went to college, her first college class, when it was over, she called me, and her comment was she was so appreciative of her education because she knew how to be herself, interact with a professor, engage in conversation, ask tough questions. It had nothing to do with the classical material. It had to do with teaching the whole child. And in my experience, the amount of effort that sometimes is more than your neighbor, when it's healthy, is what sets your child up for freedom at the next stage of life. And I think that's the real proposition we need to look at.
Well said. And again, a great reminder that the fruit of this is it is a lot of work. And in the end, there are so many students that walk out really ready for the real world and the hard challenges they're going to face. So great word as always. Thanks, Keith. Got a question for Keith to answer on a future McCurdy moment? Well, send it to us at info@basecamplive.com and learn more about Keith McCurdy on the speaking page on the Basecamp Live website. Okay, Brooke, we're back and ready to hear what's this idea of heads and hands and hearts and how all those work together. What have you discovered?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that I've discovered it, but we've really been thinking a lot about even just what we just discussed. We're talking about education. And if you think about what education is, it's typically the imparting of information. You're trying to train someone up in some way, but it actually is different than formation, or it's not always formative. Discipleship is clearly formative, but education isn't always meant that. It was like, you know, I want to impart an idea. I want to help you learn something. That doesn't always change us. And so we've really been wrestling with, we keep digging in on mental health and emotional health and why is that so important? I think we're seeing that that's a little bit of the disconnect. And we saw it, especially in this particular study, this time where we dug in on emotions a bit more. We dug in on what I would call their outward look, their missional capacity, Gen Z. And we definitely saw a disconnect between head, heart, and hands. So even if they had all the Sunday school answers right, they aren't letting that change their heart and they aren't letting that change their hands, and vice versa. The ones we saw who were engaged and active missionally in some way, whatever way that might've been, they had a better, deeper understanding of kind of biblical foundations. And also their heart was more attuned to their faith, right? So it really is a package, and that's hard as, you know, a school to accomplish. But when you're working together with the whole community of parents and church and school, that's when you form. And so I think there's a really interesting kind of review for us to do of what are we doing in education? Are we just imparting head knowledge like you were just describing, before the break about, you know, we learn lots of things about the Bible, but we actually don't know what to do with the Bible until we talk about formation and character and our emotional health. So those are the sorts of things that help this to connect to the person, not just be tick in the box of I learned this today.
And I often have said, you know, the secret sauce, if to use that term, of classical Christian education, especially when it comes to reading the great books. Again, I think a lot of people see that as well. They're just hard to read. It's, you know, let's chew on some gravel and get bigger mental muscles. That's not really the point. In fact, that's not the point. The point is I always think of it in terms of you're getting an inoculation. You're reading the story of someone who's gone before you, either, you know, because of their virtues or their vices that really give you a way to kind of vicariously live through what were good decisions and bad decisions. And I think that's the thing that's so lacking, is that there's not a lot of heroes. There are not many people that are really role models for young people today that say, this is kind of how you navigate life. And to your point, I think as we create these, you know, classroom discussions or living out in our homes, we're creating pathways for students to find, okay, that's who I want to emulate. That's how I want to make these decisions versus those. So it sounds like that would help free the anxiety of tumbling around, not knowing what you want to begin with. So.
Yes. Yes. And there's something about, as you said, knowing that someone's gone before you and you start to kind of realize these things that I might be experiencing, even though they are in some ways very different, our basic humanity is the same. And we see that because we are as God created us and the world is as God created it. And even though we shape it as humans, it is at its core relatively the same over time. Yeah. There's nothing new under the sun. And so right. that connection, there's actually a great sense of peace for young people in that. And we've seen lots of different ways in which that shows up, that they're yearning for something that's timeless and unchangeable because they're in such a rapidly changing world. And when they have that connection, that's why I think classical is so great, because when they have that connection to things that have stood the test of time, they go, okay, well, this thing that's happening right now isn't going to overwhelm me because I'm still going to be here.
But it sounds like the real enemy is compartmentalization, where you had this amazing teacher who gave you these ideas, but then you walk out and you've got a completely different narrative from your peers or the media or whatever else. And it sounds like, you know, we were talking before we began, there's some professors at Fuller that have done a number of research pieces over the years, just looking at kind of what creates sticky faith and this idea of the 5-to-1 ratio that we've talked about, meaning there's got to be more than one voice that sort of champions Christ-centered worldview in your life. It's got to be your parents. It's got to be the church. It's got to be the school. So so talk a little bit about that, because it's really what we're talking about is creating a continuous thread that they can follow. Like, this is the path forward, as opposed to splintering of so many different voices.
Yeah. Well, sticky faith is a great example. So Kara Powell at Fuller Youth Institute, we've done some work with her for a number of years. She does great research. It's more qualitative. And so she'll kind of follow, or anthropological perhaps, and she'll follow different youth or youth organizations. She does a lot with youth ministry and looks at what creates resilience. And in this case, resilience of faith, but I think we're also seeing resilience of individuals in the world. And so, yes, having those mentors, those real life people who are not just your parents who are teaching you things, but people who disciple you, who you watch and learn from, just as Jesus discipled his disciples and showed them, not just taught them. And I think that is one of the things we've seen is critical to having this resilient faith. And Kara has a new book out about the three questions, which really touch on the three that we've been talking about: identity, belonging, and purpose. It is like, who am I? Where do I fit in? And what good am I going to do in the world? Right. And all those questions came from research she did with teens, where she was asking them all their questions about life. And really, they all boiled down to those three things that are just true about us as humans. Yeah. We want to know those three things.
Yeah. Which, yeah, it sounds like, I mean, a lot of folks are thinking about this right now. So we talked earlier, great example of Heritage, which, by the way, I love hearing about Heritage stories since I was there for years out of school. And, and it's so joyous to me to think high school's here. You've worked so hard to get it here. And you guys are in this really interesting moment because you've been able to, without any legacy issues, like, let's build a classical Christian high school with a complete mindfulness of who this generation is and the world in which they're stepping. So we're going to change some things. We're going to do some things differently. You're doing Bible differently. What are some practicals? Maybe it's some things that you're actually doing there at Heritage, or just, again, things you would advocate for as parents, as educators, to help counter everything you've described earlier as the trends within Gen Z.
Yeah, I actually think it's interesting because there's this tension of acknowledging the reality of the culture and holding up all that is good and true and timeless and beautiful. And so they're doing both. They've got them in this beautiful mahogany library with all these classic books all around them. And then they also have their laptop, and they bring their laptop and they learn how to use it in that function. So that's just a tangible example of how that happens. But they're not kind of saying, oh, we're going to isolate and we're just going to study the old, or that's the only thing that's good. They're saying, no, we're going to use technology for what it's good for, and we're going to help it find its place. And then we're going to help us make space without technology when we need to focus and have good conversation together, right? So they're helping them physically learn how to live with those two, in tandem, in tension. And giving them more freedoms, because the only way to see if you're prepared to make wise decisions is to try things and have small failures. And so let's do that in a loving and supportive community and experience what do we do about this sort of, issue that we've come up with. So that, I think that has been a huge part of it. They also had all of us read John Stonestreet and Brett Kunkel's Practical Guide to Culture, which I highly recommend. I've heard him speak on a number of occasions, and I know their philosophy about culture is, look, we as people make culture. It's not this bad thing that happens to us. It is the world that we live in. It's how we shaped it. And if we see culture as bad, then we also see all of the other people in culture as bad. And that's not the goal. The goal is to say what in culture does not fit with what's true of God, and how then ought we to live given that. And so how do we live in both, truly in the world, but also not letting that world come in and shape us away from biblical standards?
Well, and I think it really is, as you're saying, and how do we shape culture? I think, again, if there's kind of a theme we keep coming back to, it's like, you can't assume anything. You can't assume just because you're in a Christian home, you're going to have this output, or you can't assume just because years ago we didn't have this technology problem, now our kids are going to figure it out. I love that idea of, like, let's actually be intentional and have a discussion of where this laptop and this great book sit next to each other, as opposed to forgetting that there's a laptop world and only being the great book school. And it's a tenuous thing. I mean, and people will accuse and say, well, yeah, but you're compromising, you're trying to be relevant and all that stuff. And it's we've got to, like, model this and walk them through it. So are there some other, this is very helpful, are there other examples, either again from what the school's doing or what you would just observe and recommend as a parent today or as an educator?
I think the most important is to keep helping them to see the bigger picture. And that's something that's subtle, but I mean, even this past week, there was an email that came out from the academic dean, and it was describing some new logistical things. But even in that email, there is a, here's why we are doing it this way. Everything is intentional. Here's why we think this is good for all of us together, and we're all going to be, you know, helping each other through this. So, I mean, always adding that aspirational, broader context, I think, really helps. And then just the model of helping them maintain curiosity and helping them wrestle with things means that conversations that they start in class about whatever they're reading continue at our dinner table. So you're talking about you read Frankenstein in class, and you're talking about what is beauty and how do we get our sense of what is beauty and how do we get our sense of man's ability as a creator or not. And we're going to keep talking about that at the dinner table. So what does that mean for us when I'm building with Legos, or what are my, you know, desires? What am I trying to do there? So our kids, you know, we keep classroom going. Our kids are used to that. Dinner takes an hour and a half every night because we just keep talking about whatever it is they're learning, so that it's not like you learn that and you put it away. It's like, oh my goodness, share with me the adventure you've been on today. And how do we think about that? And how does it affect us as a family and you as an individual and us as a community? What does that mean for us? So it's that conversation.
I love that. I mean, the practical thing I'm thinking about, especially as you get sort of that middle school boy and you ask that question, what did you learn today? Might not get a whole lot of answer out. And also just the gap that unfortunately exists between the school and home. And there are some schools that maybe do a better job of kind of saying, hey, this is what we're studying this week. These are some questions you could ask at home. I mean, are you guys doing that level of detail?
Which I would highly encourage that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our high school, especially our middle school a little bit.
Wow.
Because it's hard. You don't see their work as much. So it's hard to know exactly what they're working on.
That's what I was thinking. Right.
Yeah. So they have been sending out a monthly message, weekly for middle school, monthly for high school, saying, here's all the stuff we're studying. Here's kind of the topics we're touching on. Here's some of the issues that we're wrestling with. Even last year that came up where, you know, they were reading a couple of books where it was like, oh, these are some difficult things that are going to come up that you might want to talk about as a family that come out of this. And so like they read The Diary of Anne Frank and they're like, there's a lot that's heavy here. Let's not end that in the classroom. Let's make sure your kids have space to process this a bit further, because these are heavy concepts. And so as a parent, we're just like, absolutely bring that on, because A, that training continues at home, and B, I just want to be more connected to my kids, and it gives me a way to do that.
That is obviously a lot of extra work on the part of the school. Very commendable, because you have to turn around now after a long day and summarize it and put it out there. But I think that's genius. And I think there's so many parents that are continually looking over the shoulder of their own student and saying, gosh, I wish I had some of this myself. We did a podcast a couple weeks back with Doug Henry at Baylor, and they're currently doing this 100 Days of Dante. And so the idea is actually taking Dante and breaking it up into this bite-sized pieces that the average person who wasn't classically educated can get access to. But I think that's something that schools could do more and more of, as you're just describing, which is both inviting them into these conversations, because it's hard when your kids have had very sophisticated conversations, you're not even sure how to enter in, you haven't even read the book. So kind of a cheat sheet for parents, I guess, is what this is to take.
Totally.
Up.
Or, yeah. I mean, you know, if you really want to be creative about it, I think parents would pay for a quarterly seminar that they would show up to.
Absolutely.
And they get to experience.
I know. Well, I know a lot of schools that do back to school nights that are literally, here's a small reading and come taste and see and experience. And it's energizing because most of us, like our average kids, they don't live in a very thoughtful world. And to sit around and have a piece of literature that it's, again, if you've not figured this out, it's not just, you know, reminiscing in the past. This is actually dipping into the past to engage the modern world because there is nothing new under the sun, as you mentioned earlier. Yeah. So,
and one other thing on that I think is really important is it's hard as a parent, but you kind of are playing psychologist a lot. It's like, what is my kid taking away from this, right? Or how is this shaping the way they're thinking about something? And I think there's a lot of work to be done to say, oh, when they read this or have that conversation, what is that telling them about themselves or about the world or about God? And let's dig in there to make sure I understand what they're taking away from it, because that's how it goes from being just head knowledge to formative. And also that is so helpful for them to give them this very subconscious sense of, hey, I don't have to have all the answers to everything. I'm not going to have all the answers to everything. And actually, things are really complicated, but it's okay that they're really complicated, because those are the sorts of things that create sense of anxiety and overwhelm when students don't have things that fit neatly in boxes and haven't been trained to operate outside of those neat boxes. And then they get into the real world and it's messy and it's complicated. They don't know how to mentally process that. Well, we're teaching them that by this sort of dialogue, by not having everything clear and kind of multiple choice.
Well, and anchoring it back to these most important questions, which I can, as you said, that I was thinking of a school that literally in every classroom put on the wall above the whiteboard or wherever it was in the classroom, that just the two questions you always have to ask, you know, what does this say about God? What does this say about me or about humanity? And I think if we could sort of constantly filter it at that level, then to your point, it's not some esoteric conversation and that would make three PhDs in humanities excited about the Frankenstein book. Like, that's not the point. It's really about what is this journey this character's been on have to do with the very basic questions you woke up this morning as a 15-year-old asking yourself, like, well, where is God and where am
exactly.
I?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly. And through that, you're modeling what it looks like to connect head, heart, and hand.
Yeah, that's so well said. Well, Brooke, I know there's more we can talk about. I hopefully folks are eager to dig in more and understand Gen Z, because again, it's like another culture, another people, and how do we understand them better? So mention again, if you will, what resources Barna has if you want to dig in deep and talk about this would be very helpful.
Yeah. So we have a Gen Z Volume 1 and Volume 2. And in fact, with Volume 2, when we launched that, there's even an educator's kit, which is kind of a collection of some videos and extra material. So you can even buy some complimentary things to work through it. So it's not just a book. And those are great resources. Volume 2 is the most recent of them. We also have, you know, a number of different things for depending on the role that people are in. We have Guiding Children, which is about how to think about biblical formation and education in the broader sense of that 6 to 12 age, which is very interesting. So it's that young, like end of elementary, middle school, formative, you know, mentally formative stage. How do they think about scripture? So that's a great resource. And then a number of things on youth ministry. But if people go to barna.com, there's a whole section on youth and Gen Z, and that's really a great place to start.
Well, that sounds great. Well, can I ask by closing question, what's next? What big research are you guys jumping in, in the future? I'm very curious. Would love to keep following this.
A lot of what we're trying to figure out now is how do you make sense of this kind of hybrid world we've opened up? So whether that's for churches or for other environments, in what ways have we potentially changed the model by introducing, you know, digital and in person to a variety of things? So we've been doing a lot of research around that. And that's tricky because you can never look at the current and figure out where things are going. So you have to make some projections. But we're looking at some people who use best practices And what are some of the things that they found important to navigate that kind of hybrid world that we're in?
Sounds fascinating. Well, Brooke Kimball, thanks so much for being back on Basecamp. We'll definitely have you back and get the next report of the research and what's going on in the culture, since it's constantly changing. And we appreciate you helping us sort all this out. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hey, Basecamp Live listeners, thank you again for listening to this episode and for your faithful support and encouragement for going on 4 years of podcasting. It was so good to meet many of you in person this summer at the ACCS and SCL conferences, and I always appreciate getting your emails. Reach out to me. Let me know where you're listening from, what's on your mind. You can get to me at info@basecamplive.com. This fall is going to be an exciting time for Basecamp Live, with some new formats and updates coming to the show. We are also grateful for the number of individuals and organizations who partner with us. So a quick shout out to these groups, who I know personally, their leaders and the quality of the resources that they provide both to individuals and to schools. First of all, the focus group. If you're running a capital campaign or working on a major donor development project, they are accomplished, skilled, and ready to serve you. Secondly, Classical Academic Press. Chris Perrin and his team continue to build a wealth of curriculum and training materials for your classical Christian education, whether you're teaching at home or at school. Thirdly, Scola Inbound Marketing. Their proven model is helping schools attract and keep new families, a value to any school. And then fourthly, the CLT, or Classic Learning Test. Jeremy Tate and his team provide students with an alternative standardized test that is a much better way for students to demonstrate their knowledge and abilities. As we know, the SAT and ACT are being set aside by so many colleges and universities. So thank you so much for these resources and options that are given to us by these great sponsors. Finally, again, let us know where you're listening from. info@basecamplive.com. We'll connect with you again on our next episode. Thanks again for listening.